The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And we will begin today with a health article entitled Death Has Two Timelines by Sunita Puri. The first person who taught me something about death and defiance was the mother of a family friend, an older woman who had moved from Punjab to the United States to be closer to her son. I remember her as delicate and draped always in pastel salwar kameezes. After she was diagnosed with breast cancer, which moved quickly to claim her bones and her brain, her desire to return to Punjab intensified. When my parents told me about the end of her life, it was with a mixture of disbelief and conviction. She survived the days-long journey to the village where she had been born, laboring to breathe for nearly the entire flight, grimacing through prayers when she ran out of pain medication, and died 2 days after she arrived. I thought of her story this week as I read about former President Jimmy Carter's intention to live long enough to vote for Kamala Harris. Carter, who has been on hospice for well over a year, turned 100 recently and has survived far longer than many expected he would. The notion that he has rallied in order to contribute in one final way to American democracy raises a familiar question that arises in my own work with patients and families. Do we have some control, conscious or not, over when we die? Can a person stretch the days of their life to include a last meaningful act or moment? As a palliative care physician, I have encountered this phenomena of people dying only after specific circumstances materialize. There was the gentleman whose family held vigil in the intensive care unit while he continued on, improbably, even without the support of the ventilator, dying only after his estranged son had arrived. There was the woman whose fragility precluded any further chemotherapy, but who survived long enough without it to witness the birth of her first grandchild. There was the woman who was deeply protective of her daughter and died from cirrhosis only after she'd left for the night, possibly to spare her the agony of witnessing her death. The unexpected happens frequently enough that I tell patients and families that two timelines shape the moment of death: the timeline of the body, governed by the more predictable laws of physiology, and that of the soul, which may determine the moment of death in a way that defies medical understanding and human expectations. When people wonder about the circumstance of their last heartbeat, of the final breath, I can see how they never stop searching for their loved one's personhood or intention, a last gesture that reveals or solidifies who that person is. Despite the prevalence of stories suggesting that people may have the ability to time their death, no scientific evidence supports this observation. Decades ago, several studies documented a dip in deaths just before Jewish holidays, with a corresponding rise immediately afterward, suggesting that perhaps people could choose to die after one final holiday celebration. A larger study later found that certain holidays, Christmas and Thanksgiving in this case, and personally meaningful days such as birthdays, had no significant effect on patterns of dying. But this phenomenon doesn't lend itself too easily to statistical analysis either. The importance of holidays, for instance, can't quite stand in for every individual motivations that define the anecdotes shared in hospital break rooms or around a dinner table. And the human truth that many recognize in these stories raises the question of whether we believe them any less fully in the absence of proof. Palliative care often involves helping people confront and develop a relationship to uncertainty, which governs so much of the experience of illness. And when my patients tell me about themselves and about who they are now that they are sick, willpower often makes an appearance. Many say that if they focus on the positive or visualize the disappearance of their cancer or fight hard enough, they will win the battle for more time. I hear their words echoes of what Nietzsche wrote, what the psychiatrist Viktor Frankl used to make sense of his years in German concentration camps. He who has a why to live can bear almost any how. And we want to believe that love or desire or commitment or heroism is still possible right up until the very end. As my patients grow sicker and as death approaches, I talk with them and their families about what they can hope for even if a cure isn't possible. That, in fact, death can still contain something generative. A time that may have seemed beyond further meaning becomes instead an opportunity, or an extension of the dying person's commitments to their country, their family, their dreams. Soon, President Carter will be able to cast that vote. Next week, Georgia registrars will start mailing out absentee ballots. Early voting begins the week after that. His promise to himself is a reminder that dying cannot fully dampen purpose, even as a person's life narrows. The idea that willpower can be an ally against death is appealing, too, because it offers the possibility of transcendence, of defying the limits that the body or illness may impose. But having also seen the many ways that the body does not bend to the mind, I do find myself regaling willpower with caution. What if you, as a person, are a fighter, but your body simply cannot fight the cancer any longer? I wonder with my patients if they can survive for more time without shouldering personal responsibility for the limits of biology. Similarly, two people on ventilators may love their families equally. One may die only after the final beloved family member arrives, whereas the other may die before the person rushing across the ocean makes it home. We don't always know why. If Carter casts his vote and dies shortly thereafter, that might affirm the notion that others, too, can write the final sentence in their story. But what would it mean if Carter died before casting his vote? If he lived another year, or if he lived to see Donald Trump take office again, or watch the election be violently contested? Living with loss requires remembering that we can locate the person we have loved or admired in any given set of events that comprise their life, not just the last one. I try to imagine my family friend's long flight from Los Angeles to Delhi and her ride in the taxi back to Punjab. I think about how she found a way to endure what she was told she couldn't, all to feel beneath her feet the soil she knew best, to die in the one place that she felt belonged to her. What if her doctors had been right and she had died on the plane? My family might have mourned her single-mindedness, or might have admired her defiance nonetheless. What makes these stories so compelling is that they remind us that death, however ravenous, cannot devour hope or possibility, even if what transpires is not the ending we imagined. For your information, on the date that I am recording this, Jimmy Carter has already cast his ballot. Our second article is a book review. The title of this article is This Time Bob Woodward Gets It Right. The Watergate journalist has taken a lot of hits, including from me. In his new Biden chronicle entitled War, he's at his best. This is written by Franklin Foer. At this late stage in Bob Woodward's career, it would be possible to publish an entertaining anthology of the negative reviews of his books. Although there's an ongoing debate about the journalistic merits of Woodward's reportorial mode, he has no doubt succeeded in bringing out the vitriolic best from the likes of Joan Didion, Christopher Hitchens, and Jack Schaefer. A few years back, I wrote to Woodward hoping to get his help with an article I was reporting. I decided to solicit him with a thick layer of flattery, in what I believe to be the spirit of Bob Woodward. To my embarrassment, he replied that he struggled to reconcile my fawning missive with the negative review of his book, State of Denial, that I had published in the New York Times in 2006, which, quote, strongly concludes the opposite, end quote. His response suggests that he might be the ideal editor of the anthology. Over the years, my critique of Woodward has softened considerably. It's not that the complaints about his works aren't fair. He does recite his sources' versions of events with excessive deference. He trumpets every nugget of reporting, no matter how trivial. He narrates scenes without pausing to situate them in context. But when he's in his most earnest mode, and war, his new book about President Joe Biden's navigation of the conflicts in Ukraine and the Middle East might be the most earnest of his career. He exudes an almost atavistic obsession with the gritty details of foreign policy. Woodward is the most gifted sensationalist of his generation, but it's his abiding desire to be known as a serious person that yields his most meaningful reporting. War gets to that fruitful place, but it begins in unpromising fashion. In the prologue, Woodward remembers that Carl Bernstein ran into Donald Trump at a New York dinner party back in 1989. Trump exclaimed, "Wouldn't it be amazing if Woodward and Bernstein interviewed Donald Trump?" The journalistic duo that helped bring down Richard Nixon agreed to see him the next day. Last year, Woodward went to a storage facility and began rummaging through his files in search of the lost interview. In a box filled with old newspaper clippings, he found a battered envelope containing the transcript. That's the most interesting part of the story, alas. Woodward subjects his reader to pages of Trump's banal musings. "I'm a great loyalist. I believe in loyalty to people." Because Woodward and Bernstein were the ones asking the questions, the conversation is apparently worthy of history. This is a goofy, tangential start to a book devoted to the foreign policy of the Biden presidency. The cover, which features a row of faces of global leaders, places Kamala Harris's visage in the center. It's another piece of misdirection, because the vice president is a bit player in the story. That said, Harris comes off well in her cameos. She asks diligent questions in the Situation Room. In phone calls with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, she plays the heavy, asking him about civilian casualties in Gaza. There are no instances, however, of her disagreeing substantively with Biden. The most revealing Harris comment moment comes toward the end of the book. One of Biden's friends asked her, "Could you please talk to the president more than you talk to him? Your president really loves you." Her boss's biggest disappointment was that she didn't write. She didn't call. In response to her friend's plea, Harris joked about her strongest bond with the president. "He knows that I'm the only person around who knows how to properly pronounce the word motherfucker." It's a genuinely funny exchange, and telling in its way. But these are just MacGuffins, sops to the Beltway superfans. At its core, Woodward's book is about diplomacy. Just past the sundry tidbits about Trump, most horrifying the former president's ongoing chumminess with Vladimir Putin, a charge that Trump's campaign denies, there lies a serious history of the conflicts in Ukraine and Gaza. I have reported on these stories myself, and I can't say that I found any faults in his account. If anything, I'm unashamedly jealous of how he managed to get a few big stories that eluded me. One of his most stunning sections of the book captures Putin mulling the use of a tactical nuclear weapon in Ukraine, and all the quiet diplomacy that pushed him back from the brink. Newspapers hinted at this threat at the time, but Woodward reveals the backstory in robust and chilling detail. John Finer, the deputy head of the National Security Council, said that Putin's decision on whether to deploy the nuke seemed like a coin flip. When Biden frets about the possibilities of nuclear escalation, he is not just recalling his youth in the earliest days of the Cold War. He's confronting a very real risk in the present. Unlike his predecessors, Biden was distrustful of Woodward. Old enough to remember how one of his books helped to derail Bill Clinton's first term, Biden appears to have chosen not to participate in either this history or Woodward's previous book, Peril. Having withheld access, the president comes across as lifeless. It's not that he's out to lunch. He is in command of his faculties, according to Woodward's reporting. There are just no real insights into his psychology. His decision to withdraw from the 2024 race came too close to the book's publication date for Woodward to report on the process that led the president to back away. He has very little to say about the most fascinating decision in recent political history. But in some sense, Biden and Woodward were made for each other. These two octogenarians are both avatars of a bygone era in Washington, when foreign policy was a shared obsession of the establishment. Even if Woodward doesn't find Biden personally interesting, he pores over the president's conversations with Netanyahu and Putin with genuine fascination. These aren't the scraps of reporting that moves copies, but they are clearly what he treasures. In his epilogue, he hints at how much he enjoyed covering genuine good faith efforts by the president and his core national security team to wield the levers of executive power responsibly and in the national interest. Despite his fixation on substance, Woodward fails to answer or even ask some of the bigger questions about Biden's foreign policy. Could he have done more to bolster Ukraine? Could he have pushed Israel to accept a ceasefire? But Woodward does arrive at a judgment of the presidency that strikes me as measured and fair. Based on the evidence available now, I believe President Biden and his team will largely be studied in history as an example of steady and purposeful leadership. End quote. Despite the many mistakes of this administration, I'm guessing that Woodward's verdict will pass the test of time, and that none of the reviews of war is destined for the anthology. Our third article, what do professional apple farmers think of people who pick apples for fun? By Joe Pinkster. I've gone apple picking with friends a few times, and picked berries too. As I strolled through picturesque orchards and shielded my eyes from the autumn sunlight, I couldn't help but think, this is someone's job. I work in a cubicle. How would it feel if, on the weekends, a bunch of people from a few towns over dressed themselves in business casual, gathered around my desk, and Instagrammed pictures of each other perched on my rolling chair, pretending to type away at my laptop? That's not a perfect analogy. My cubicle is anything but pastoral. This thought experiment having failed, I decided the best way to learn how apple farmers feel about going apple picking was to ask them. I have never met or heard of someone coming out to our eastern Washington apple-growing region to pick apples for leisure, Jeff Pheasant, a fifth-generation apple farmer in Soap Lake, Washington, told me. It must be an East Coast or urban thing. Pheasant Orchards employs 20 full-time and several additional part-time workers to harvest 9 million pounds of apples this year. And Pheasant found the idea of picking for fun hilarious and sad, a reflection of just how estranged from nature modern Americans must feel. We don't try to build our own furniture or cars. We don't feel the need to go to the forest ourselves to cut a tree down when we need lumber, he said, adding, our economy has raised people's quality of life by becoming more efficient and productive. I don't understand why we want to go backwards when it comes to agriculture. Pheasant was bewildered that anyone would care to pick their own apples. But another farmer I spoke with said her farm welcomes leisure pickers. Carrie Wilson, whose family's Washington farm has been operating for more than 125 years, told me what it feels like to be working while people are picking apples for fun. We're picking, and they come out to have this experience, but we become part of the zoo, she says. They look at you as if you're under the microscope. Wilson says she and her coworkers sometimes feel a need to perform for visitors. There's a belief that they're coming to see these poor, dumb people, she sighs. She says that everyone in her family has gone to college, and some hold advanced degrees. We're not stupid people, she says. Though it's a leisure activity for some, picking apples professionally is demanding work. Picking apples off a tree is not the same as being an apple picker, says Jeff Pheasant. The majority of apples in supermarkets are picked by hand, and the annual U.S. apple harvest is estimated to involve 70,000 workers. On a good day, a worker might fill up between 8 and 12 900-pound bins, according to Pheasant. Professional pickers tend to work seasonally, with many driving hundreds of miles, sometimes with their families in tow, to reap pumpkins, pears, berries, or whatever is in season in various parts of the country. Researchers at Washington State University, which is near America's biggest apple-producing region, announced last summer that they were testing an apple-picking robot. The nature of pick-your-own attractions has changed significantly in recent decades. It used to be that people would come to the fields to buy fruit cheaply and in bulk for canning. Now, Wilson says, they're coming out because they want to have little Sarah get a photo under a tree holding on to a piece of fruit. They buy two pieces of fruit or three pieces of fruit, and they walk around the orchard as if it were an animal park. Because today's pick-your-own visitors aren't buying nearly as much fruit, Wilson Banner Ranch, where Carrie Wilson works, has adapted its business model. We do make a ton of money on apple sippers when we sell cider, Wilson says. You picking is a way to attract people to encourage that sale. The other purpose pick-your-own serves now is reducing what Wilson calls the gong questions. We have people that come here and they'll say, when are the oranges going to be ready? She says. Well, if you know anything about the Pacific Northwest, the oranges will never be ready because they come from California. As I talked to apple farmers, their bewilderment at leisure picking became my own. How did the idea of picking apples for fun even come to be in the first place? There are a couple of old theories about the relationship between work and leisure, says Gary Chick, a retired professor of recreation, park, and tourism management at Penn State. First, there's the spillover theory, which holds that people spend their leisure time doing things related to their jobs. So, someone who works with heavy equipment, for example, plays with electric trains as a hobby, Chick says. In his own free time, Chick still likes doing data analysis, like the kind he did while working. And then there's the compensation theory, which says that in their free time, people do what they can forget about their professional obligations. I am not quite sure which your apples example best fits, Chick said. Sounds like some sort of compensation to me. Along with desk jobs can come a sense of disconnection from nature, and I think this is playing in, says Scott Cohen, a professor of tourism management at the University of Surrey in England. It allows for a tactile connection with nature. The work is multi-seasonal. One doesn't just see, but can smell, feel, and taste the apples. It turns out that Americans have a curious history of using their time off to observe workers, often workers engaged in physical labor. Tourism curiosity in work sites dates from the early 19th century, writes the historian Cindy S. Aaron in her book, Working at Play, Vacations in the United States. The earliest known example seems to come from the Pennsylvania coal town of Monchunk, which started attracting tourists in the 1820s. Through the rest of the century, ironworks and factories drew travelers as well. An 1888 guidebook had this tip for visiting Chicago's livestock trading center. Grain elevators are a very interesting feature and should be visited in order to obtain an idea of the manner in which the immense grain trade in Chicago is carried on. On a vacation in September of 1878, Aaron writes, a legal professional named Matthew Deedy toured a mill and a mine. In his diary, Deedy wrote that while 1,700 feet underground, he took a handful of soft, mealy ore. He continued, the thermometer was 110. I had on a flannel shirt and drawers and perspired as if in a hot bath. We reached the daylight again after hours' absence and had a most delicious tepid shower bath. Deedy's version of fun was essentially the simulated workday of a miner. The emphasis, though, should be on simulated. Upon resurfacing, the mine's owner presented him with champagne. What on earth compelled Matthew Deedy to tour a filthy, overheated mine in his leisure time? Aaron has three theories. First, and perhaps least applicable to today's apple pickers, she suggests visiting workplaces served to reinforce Americans' belief in their countrymen's ingenuity and technical expertise. Second, she writes, touring a workplace allowed middle-class vacationers to be connected to the work while they were also at play, helping perhaps to elide tensions produced by the idleness of vacationing. Again, that's a theory that probably says more about 19th century mines than 21st century orchards, which few leisure pickers associate with the idea of work. But Aaron's third idea echoes some of Carrie Wilson's feelings. Such tourism allowed middle-class tourists to measure the gulf between themselves and those whom they observed at work, marking their differences from the working class even while affirming the centrality of work to middle-class life. Wilson says that in recent years, as highbrow culture has romanticized the idea of going back to the land and working with one's hands, she has been approached by earnest young people hoping to be farmers, only to have them quit shortly after seeing how much physical work it requires. Those momentary frustrations are with every job, she says, but I think with ours, people see us at the most bountiful time of the year, so it looks glamorous. We're out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.